I'm sure we've all heard of the Basketball Hall of Fame. Of course, there's the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and there's even an Ice Hockey Hall of Fame, Hip Hop Hall of Fame, the Country Music Hall of Fame. I couldn't tell you a single person in that one. But there's even a Hall of Fame for model cars. And get this, Jay Leno is in it. Like, what qualifies you to be in the Model Car Hall of Fame? Jay Leno's not a model car. There are all kinds of halls of fame. There's a hall of fame called the AIAS Hall of Fame. It's for, apparently, video games. Obviously. Well, it seems that in every Hall of Fame, there are those members whom people wonder, why is this person in this particular Hall of Fame? I mean, consider Bobby Wallace. I don't know anything about baseball. But Bobby Wallace is in the Baseball Hall of Fame because of his spectacular, bonkers 268 batting average. I don't know much about baseball, but I know this, that ain't good. And yet, he's in it. Even more, Bill Bradley is in the Basketball Hall of Fame. You might not know who that is. He was a senator for a while. But it's like, why is he in the Basketball Hall of Fame? For his what? His one single All-Star appearance? Like, that's only one more than I have. I'm not in the Hall of Fame. But this one's even more puzzling. This is the most ridiculous Hall of Fame inductee of all time. The game, Phase 10, is in the National Toy Hall of Fame. Why is that in the Hall of Fame? That's just Yahtzee with playing cards. It's not even original. I mean, if that's in the Hall of Fame, then tic-tac-toe, the dumbest game of all time, has to be the GOAT of games. It's crazy. Sorry, I know I'm offending everyone now. Apparently a bunch of phase, we're going to have a Phase 10 tournament. I am busy that night, sorry. You know, there's another Hall of Fame that also makes no sense, and I'm referring to the Hall of Fame that we read in Hebrews 11. The author there lists men and women of great faith in history, and he makes a big deal out of Abraham and his faith, but he completely overlooks the fact that Abraham lied at least twice about his wife, claiming she was only his sister. And on one of those occasions, a king, thinking that Sarah's only his sister, takes her into his harem. It is only the grace and power of God that protected Sarah from Abraham's foolishness. But in that Hall of Fame, we come to this startling declaration in Hebrews 11. The author writes, "And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Now, we've seen that Gideon's faith enabled him to defeat the Midianite army. And then with his faith, he took a bunch of the gold and made an idol for Israel to bow down to. We've seen that Barak had to be cajoled into trusting the Lord. And while he did defeat the king of Hazor, a woman ended up receiving glory for that battle because he was so utterly weak in faith. David is also listed there as a man of great faith. The same David who forcefully took the wife of one of his closest friends, got her pregnant, and then had her husband killed in order to cover it up. His incredible abuse of power. And Samson, who's listed as we will see, was about as pagan as one could get throughout most of his life. It was probably only with his dying breath that he expressed anything that looked like real, genuine faith in the Lord. But even with these men, with all these flaws, the one that is perhaps the most shocking to me is Jephthah. Now, our text this morning is one of the darkest in the books. Not the darkest, but it is one of the darkest. Jephthah commits an act so evil, the author refuses to give it a higher word count than is absolutely necessary to convey the act. I'm struck that he's included among those who, through faith, rescued God's people. Perhaps the author of Hebrews is saying, faith is less about the person who has it and says far more about the one in whom the faith is placed. We're in Judges chapter 11, beginning in verse 29. Then the Spirit of the Lord was upon Jephthah, and he passed through Gilead and Manasseh and passed on to Mizpah of Gilead. And from Mizpah of Gilead, he passed on to the Ammonites. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will give the Ammonites into my hand, then whatever comes out from the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's, and I will offer up for a burnt offering. So Jephthah crossed over to the Ammonites to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand. And he struck them from Aroer to the neighborhood of Minnith, 20 cities, and as far as Abel-Karamim with a great blow. So the Ammonites were subdued before the people of Israel. Then Jephthah came to his home at Mizpah, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him with tambourines and with dances. She was his only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. And as soon as he saw her, he tore his clothes and said, alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you have become the cause of great trouble to me. For I have opened my mouth to the Lord, and I cannot take back my vow. And she said to him, my father, you have opened your mouth to the Lord. Do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth, now that the Lord has avenged you on your enemies, on the Ammonites. So she said to her father, let this thing be done for me. Leave me alone 2 months, that I may go up and down on the mountains and weep for my virginity, I and my companions. So he said, go. Then he sent her away for 2 months, and she departed, she and her companions, and wept for her virginity on the mountains. And at the end of the 2 months, she returned to her father, who did with her according to his vow that he had made. She had never known a man, and it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went year by year to lament the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite 4 days in the year. Hall of Fame. As we're going to see in the coming weeks, the coming chapters, the book of Judges is not actually written in a strict chronological order. Some of the events that are yet to come actually happened very early in Israel's time in the land of Canaan. The author, inspired by the Spirit of God, was communicating something significant by structuring the book in this manner. Right? He's illustrating Israel's increasing depravity, their increasing unfaithfulness to God. And as we're going to see, that unfaithfulness was actually there from the beginning. He simply chose to reveal it in a progressive manner. Well, we've been through the book, about halfway through it now. It begins with the book, or the judge Othniel. He's presented, as you know, as the ideal Israelite. He was faithful. He took his responsibility to deliver Israel seriously. The Lord raised him up as a judge. He engaged in battle, and he delivered Israel from their enemies. In fact, he was the one who defeated Israel's greatest enemy during the time of the judges. He defeated Cushan-Rishathaim in battle. He forced the king of Mesopotamia to leave Israel's territory and to never mess with them again. In fact, the very fact that Cushan-Rishathaim attacked Israel from his actual kingdom indicates just how powerful he was. He was in Mesopotamia. See, he was more than a king. He was an emperor who was seeking to expand his empire. Yet through Othniel's faithfulness to the Lord, God put him in his place, and he never bothered Israel again. And then we saw Ehud. Ehud also was faithful, yet Ehud relied a bit much on human cunning to defeat Moab. But then came Shamgar. Shamgar, very little is said about him, but he defeated the Philistines. We saw Deborah. Even though Deborah wasn't a warrior, Deborah was still a judge who imposed justice on the people of Israel. She helped them follow the Lord. She imposed justice by helping them to settle their disputes. And through her, she brought justice because she's the one God used to force Barak to actually engage in battle. Because of his fearfulness, because of his delay in engaging in the battle, the glory of war was given to a woman. Gideon, we saw, was a mixture of faith, but also a mixture of faith with a refusal to exercise faith. Remember, he required lots of building up. He was unsure of himself. God gave him everything he needed, and it quickly went to his head. He began to grasp for more than what the Lord gave him, right? He sought the trappings of being king without wanting the title king. Then his son Abimelech also grasped for what was not given him. His 70 brothers rejected him, and so he brutally murdered them one by one so he could finally get the respect he thought he deserved. course, Abimelech also met a brutal end. Today, we find ourselves looking at Jephthah. Like Abimelech, he's the offspring of an immoral relationship. In his case, his father did adopt him and granted him an inheritance. But as we saw last week, after his father died, his brothers wanted to strip him of his inheritance and kick him out of the father's household, and so they sued him. The city leaders sided with the brothers, and Jephthah had to flee to live elsewhere until they were desperate for him. See, they needed a warrior to lead them against the Ammonites who had been oppressing God's people. They were threatening to invade. So they agreed to make him their head and their leader. Not only would he be commander during the battle, he would remain their leader after the war was over. So he, like Abimelech, would finally get the respect and the love and the admiration he had been longing for. Now, just like Abimelech, the author doesn't say that the Lord raised him up to be a judge. He was chosen by the people. In fact, the Lord is strangely quiet throughout this entire episode. When he negotiated with the leaders of Gilead to be both military commander and their ongoing leader, the Lord was silent. When he took his oath of office for these roles, the Lord was silent. And all throughout our text this morning, the Lord doesn't speak. The only hint of the Lord's involvement is the remarkable declaration that the Spirit of the Lord was upon Jephthah. You see, like faith, the Spirit empowering Jephthah says more about the Lord than it actually does about Jephthah. Remember in chapter 10, we read that the Lord was growing impatient with Israel's misery. That is, he was starting to prepare to do something about it. Empowered by the Spirit, Jephthah travels around the immediate region. He's gathering more men to his army to fight against the Ammonites. So when the author says the Spirit of the Lord was upon him, it doesn't mean the Spirit was on him the way we have the Spirit present today. Paul told the Galatians that how they know they are the people of God is the Holy Spirit is present and active among them. That's not what the author in our text means. The Spirit coming upon Jephthah is not an indication of the Lord's approval of Jephthah. Rather than an indication of the Spirit's endorsement, the Spirit coming upon Jephthah is an indication the Spirit is about to do something about Israel's misery. He's intending to rescue Israel. So God empowers this particular person for the specific task of rescuing and delivering Israel. And then in verse 30, we read that Jephthah made a vow to the Lord. Vows to the Lord were actually quite common in ancient Israel. But Jephthah's not just merely promising to do something. He's actually negotiating with the Lord. So remember, he negotiated with the leaders of Gilead to get more from them than they wanted to give him. Rather than being just a military leader, he's going to remain their leader after the war. And once he got them to concede this to him, he thought he could negotiate with the Ammonites. But this failed, and failed badly, largely because he did not give them anything they might want. See, when you negotiate, you have to give up something. Here's our smarty word for the kids. When you negotiate, you have to give up something you want in order to get something else that you want. And the thing you have to give up is what the other party wants from you. It's really just more sophisticated haggling. When Jephthah negotiated with Ammon, he made sure he would receive all the glory, and they would receive all the shame. He gave nothing in return for them stopping their attack on Israel. That's a losing negotiating strategy. Every time. If you negotiate that way, you're going to lose every negotiation. But when he negotiates with the Lord, he aims to correct this tactical mistake. He realizes he's got to give something of value in exchange for what he wants. So he promises the Lord that if the Lord will give him victory over the Ammonites, then when he returns home, he will offer to the Lord the first thing that comes out of the doors of his house as a burnt offering. Now, we're immediately struck by this, in part because we're not ancient Near Eastern people. See, in the ancient world, animals were often kept indoors at night. They were sheltered inside in order to protect them from predators or perhaps from thieves. But even if a bull or a goat were inside his house when he returned home, it would be extremely unlikely for that animal to greet him at the door. Kind of like you'd expect a dog. Your dog, if you have a dog, you know your dog greets you like you've been gone 10 seconds and it's like, oh my gosh, I haven't seen you in a week. Maybe that's just our dog. Israelites didn't keep dogs as pets. But even if the bull or the goat were inside, it expecting such an animal to greet you at the door like a lapdog is just, it's absurd. It may be that Jephthah was expecting an animal to actually come out of his house. It's very unlikely, though, because his own words are deliberately fuzzy. There's two scholars, Mark Boda and Mary Conway, they explained it this way. It is likely that he deliberately left the terms of the vow ambiguous in order to leave himself a possible loophole. He planned his vow so that it would appear that he was offering his precious daughter a valuable pledge in exchange for a highly desirable outcome, but connived that, or desperately hoped that, he could arrange to sacrifice an animal or lesser person instead. In effect, he planned to cheat Yahweh. We saw that when he returned to Mizpah, he took his oath of office before the Lord, right? More importantly, in front of the army at Mizpah. See, Jephthah understands the importance of image, of perception. By offering whatever comes out of his doors, he appears to be offering to sacrifice his daughter as an expression of his desire to win the battle. But that seems really strange to us, doesn't it? It seems incredibly foolish and rash, but in the ancient world, this would have appeared very pious and devoted. Remember why Israel was being oppressed in the first place. Remember, they abandoned the Lord. They worshiped the Baals and the Ashtaroth, the gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of the Ammonites, the gods of Moab, the gods of the Philistines. One of the significant gods the Ammonites worshiped, and therefore Israel worshiped, was Molech. The law of Moses recognized the danger Molech worship posed to God's people, and so it warned Israel concerning this. It says this in Leviticus. You shall not give any of your children to offer them to Molech, and so profane the name of your God, I am Yahweh. See, Molech was worshipped through child sacrifice. By making this foolish vow to the Lord, the God of Israel, Jephthah is making himself appear to be very devoted and very committed to rescuing Israel. How committed? He'd give up his own daughter for victory. What a guy. See, the Ammonites and the Israelites who also worshipped the god Molech would have seen this for what Jephthah intended. Now, Jephthah, for his part, was desperately hoping an animal or perhaps one of his servants, he's not the leader after all, perhaps maybe one of his servants would come out through his door. But hey, if you want to make an omelet, got to break some eggshells, am I right? If you want to be great, you got to be willing to do what no one else would do. It's the price you pay. You know, it could have been entirely appropriate if Jephthah had said, if you will give the Ammonites into my hand, then I will offer a burnt offering. It's still a bit manipulative. He's still trying to negotiate, but such an offering is the idea would be it would be an animal. It could be the right response to God's mercy and grace. I mean, he shouldn't be negotiating with God at all, but at least he would be offering something legitimate. He could have said, when I return, I will worship you through sacrifice. That would be an entirely appropriate response to the Lord. By inserting whatever comes out of the door of my house into the equation, Jephthah is being rash and attempting to manipulate Yahweh, God of Israel. But again, notice throughout this story, the utter silence of the Lord. When the people made him leader and head, the Lord was silent. When Jephthah made his vows before oath of office before the army at Mizpah, the Lord was silent. And when he makes this utterly evil and wicked vow, God is absolutely silent. Well, immediately after making this vow, the author just moves very swiftly, very succinctly states that Jephthah met the Ammonites in battle, and the Lord gave them into his hand. Remember, the Spirit of the Lord is upon him, empowering him to be victorious. He pursued the fleeing Ammonite army. He says he destroyed 20 cities, think really fortresses, and Israel is finally freed of the threat and the oppression of the Ammonites. Verse 34 then says, he returned to his home at Mizpah. Remember in the last chapter, or earlier in the chapter, when they made him leader and head, he was living in Tob because he had been chased out of Mizpah. Apparently, he's taken the time necessary to get a house in Mizpah and establish his household, complete with animals and household goods, and most importantly, with his daughter. Certainly, messengers would have gone ahead of him as he's returning from victory or from the battle, sharing the good news of victory, so that when his daughter sees dad coming home as a conquering hero, that she does not do what proud daughters do when dad's a hero, right? Greet him with tambourines and dancing. I mean, her dad's a hero. She wants to celebrate this with dad. Good job, dad. I'm proud of you. Then Jephthah's greatest fear comes true. His daughter was the very first person to come out of his house. In verse 35, though, he blames her. He barks at her that she has brought him low. She has become the cause of his great trouble. Except she didn't make the foolish vow. How's it her fault? Well, like his father Adam, he simply blames the closest woman he can find. The real problem here for Jephthah is he's made a vow to the Lord. The law of Moses is very clear about those who would make a vow to the Lord. Deuteronomy 23 says, if you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay fulfilling it. For the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and you will be guilty of sin. You don't make a vow and then fail to keep the vow. But the law of Moses was equally clear about the content of the vow Jephthah made. Also in Deuteronomy, when you come into the land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not learn to follow the abominable practices of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone who burns his son or his daughter as an offering, anyone who practices divination or tells fortunes or interprets omens or a sorcerer or a charmer or a medium or a necromancer or one who inquires of the dead. For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord. And because of these abominations, the Lord your God is driving them out, the nations, from before you. See, on the one hand, Jephthah must fulfill his vow. On the other hand, Jephthah cannot fulfill that vow. He is truly between the proverbial rock and a hard place. He cannot turn to the one side. He must not turn to the other side. By attempting to manipulate the Lord into giving him victory, he has placed himself in a very difficult spot. You know, all of this could have been avoided if Jephthah had simply been a true Israelite and had meditated on the law of God given to Israel. In fact, he, along with Israel, would have known child sacrifice was a great evil on the level, as we see, of worshiping demons. That's how significant it is. Then again, had he, along with Israel, meditated on the law given to Israel, they wouldn't have been worshiping the Baals and the Ashtaroth and the gods of Syria and the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the Ammonites, the gods of the Philistines. Had they worshiped Yahweh, God of Israel, alone, they wouldn't have been in need of rescue in the first place. Well, Jephthah finds himself compelled to keep a vow to the Lord that he must not keep. The Lord has actually provided for such an occasion, however. There's another option for fulfilling a vow that's related to people. Leviticus 27 speaks of it. It says, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, if anyone makes a special vow to the Lord involving the valuation of a person. Now, the context, without me having to read it all, is about making vows concerning people. Vows that for one reason or another cannot ultimately be fulfilled. So the law provided Israelites the opportunity to make monetary compensation for breaking a vow. They could fulfill it through a gift to the tabernacle. The law provided the opportunity to make compensation for the vow based on a person's age and ability to work. We see these sorts of vows elsewhere in Scripture. In fact, in 1 Samuel, there's a woman named Hannah who is barren. She asks the Lord for a child. She says, if God will give her son will be devoted to the Lord and serve the Lord for his entire life. Well, God gave her a son named Samuel. Samuel was given to the priest at Shiloh. They visited him regularly. But he was given to the priest at Shiloh, where the tabernacle was at Shiloh. And he served the Lord. That's the sort of vow that God had in mind there in Leviticus 27. Now, if a person made such a vow and for some reason was unable to fulfill the vow, there was a monetary cost to redeem the person. Now, in context, the amount of money that it cost was quite high. That was meant to encourage Israel to not make such vows involving people. But in the event there was a vow that could not be fulfilled, and surely Jephthah's vow is a vow that cannot be fulfilled, then provision was made. Look, even if you couldn't afford the high price, this is what's so crazy about God. Even if you couldn't afford the extraordinarily high prices that were placed in the law, there was still provision made. Leviticus goes on to say this, and if someone is too poor to pay the valuation, then he shall be made to stand before the priest, and the priest shall value him. The priest shall value him according to what the vower can afford. Well, Jephthah made a vow, but the vow cannot be fulfilled in a way that honors the Lord, so he should have paid the necessary price to redeem his daughter. He certainly had the financial resources. He would have had all the spoils of the war. Plus, he was the leader. They were paying him a regular salary of some sort. He would have had the resources. He could have gone before the priest, the high priest in Israel. He could have paid the price to redeem her. But his daughter understands the significance of keeping his vow. She doesn't know the law either, just like he doesn't. But she understands the significance of doing what you say you will do. So she tells him in verse 36 that he's the one who opened his mouth. Now, I think in Hebrew it probably says big fat mouth, but I don't know. ESV left that part out. She says, since you opened your big fat mouth, let me have some time to weep and lament the fact that I'm going to die, that I'm not going to get married and have children, and then you can go on and do what you said you would do. So she spends 2 months with her friends to weep for her virginity, right? She's not going to get married. She knows what her father's going to do. But she also knows that since she is Jephthah's only child, the line of Jephthah will end with her death. Daniel Block cuts right to the chase. Tragically and ironically, the man whose basic gift was facility with words falls prey to his own foolish utterance. How often our strengths become our weaknesses. Jephthah's reliance on his ability to negotiate cost him everything. The truth is, God gave him an option, though. There was a way out. He could have redeemed his daughter, but he did not. That wasn't the only option he was given. He had another option available to him. He could have spared his daughter, and he could have received the curse for breaking his vow on himself. He could have paid for his own sin instead of making his daughter pay for his own sin. He could have faced the consequences. He did not. He chose the worst possible option. The author, with an obvious sneer and disgust, said he did with her according to his vow that he had made. And he won't give it another word. Jephthah kills his own daughter. Once again, we see a deliverer raised up to rescue Israel who becomes Israel's oppressor, right? By sacrificing his daughter, Jephthah is the oppressor, just like Gideon, just like Abimelech. By engaging in the very sin and wickedness that led to the oppression at the hands of the Ammonites, Jephthah becomes the oppressor. Remember, the story of Jephthah began in chapter 10 with the declaration that Jephthah was the son of a prostitute. We saw last week that this was a condemnation of the nation as a whole and not merely that of his father and his mother, right? The economic system that led to his mother being a prostitute revealed just how far Israel has fallen. The system itself condemns Israel because such an industry shouldn't even be possible in the land where Yahweh, God of Israel, was worshipped. That was the problem, however. The land was not the land where Yahweh, God of Israel, was worshipped. Remember, we saw in chapter 8, when Gideon defeated the Midianites, he rescued Israel. He took gold from the spoils of war, and he made a golden ephod, with the result that, quote, all Israel whored after it there, and it became a snare to them. And then after Gideon dies, we read this in chapter 8. As soon as Gideon died, the people of Israel turned again and whored after the Baals and made Baal-berith their god. And the people of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hand of all their enemies on every side. Jephthah was truly the son of a prostitute because he was a son of Israel. Remember, much of the story of Judges is told out of order so as to structure it in a series of increasing depravity, increasing unfaithfulness. We're going to see that the events that take place chapter 17 through 21 actually happened during the lifetime of Phinehas, the high priest of Israel. Phinehas, the grandson of Aaron. Aaron doesn't go into the land. His son Eleazar does, right? Israel The author tells it this way to show something about Israel. It's revealing something for later generations. Israel needs to understand they need a rescuer, a real-life, true deliverer, a Messiah who would be righteous and faithful, who would gladly pay the price to redeem his people, even if it meant even if it would mean taking the curse upon himself. These are the very things Jephthah refuses to do, and yet these are the very things the one true Messiah would come to do. Now, the structure of increasing depravity and increasing unfaithfulness reveals the truth that God did not claim Israel to be his people because they were so great as a people. Right? His choice that they would be his people, his holy nation out of all nations on earth, had nothing to do with how holy they were or how great they were. He chose to make them his people to show how great he is. When we read of Jephthah's faith in Hebrews, we're struck because we don't see any real evidence of faith. He sacrificed his daughter on the altar of ambition as an act of worship of the god Molech while claiming it was for Yahweh, God of Israel. I mean, if the author of Hebrews had simply written that time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, of David and Samuel and the prophets, we wouldn't miss a beat. We wouldn't recognize the omission of someone like Jephthah, for surely he doesn't belong in the Hall of Fame when it comes to faith. What if faith says less about the person who believes and more about the person who is believed in? In Luke 17, Luke tells the story of the disciples, the 12 apostles. They plead with Jesus, Lord, increase our faith. Here's his response to this. The Lord said, if you had faith like a grain of mustard seed, you could say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it would obey you. Now, the particular species of tree he mentions here was known for having a deep and extensive root system. Pulling up a tree by its roots would be a truly difficult undertaking. Probably, at least a decently sized tree, would be impossible for a human. Jesus says that even a tiny bit of faith would be sufficient to tell such a tree to go jump in a lake, and it'll go jump in a lake. But it's not because the faith makes that happen. It's because the one the faith is in is able to make that happen. It's hard to say Jephthah had any faith at all based on his actions and words in Judges. But the author of Hebrews says that by faith, Jephthah put foreign armies to flight. It wasn't the greatness of Jephthah's faith that did this, but the greatness of the one he trusted in, at least during the battle. Church, the size of your faith doesn't affect the power of God in any way. The tininess of your faith does not diminish God's power to save in the slightest. God is who he is. His power is what it is. His desire to save is not dependent on those he will save. Yes, Israel was a mess, but they were God's mess, and he chose to rescue them. This is why negotiating with the Lord is foolish, because God needs nothing we can offer him. When you negotiate, you have to give something the other party wants in exchange for something from them that you want. Obviously, God has lots of stuff that we want, but what could we possibly offer him? What do we have to give him? There must be a give and take. That's how negotiation works. The problem with trying to negotiate God is there's nothing we can offer him, and there's nothing that he could possibly need from us. Look, even if it were intellectually possible, if we could imagine a scenario in which God, the creator of everything that exists, could possibly find himself in need of some sort, why on earth would we ever think he'd come to us to meet that need? That just doesn't make any sense. See, faith is not something we offer the Lord as if he needed it from us. God lacks nothing and therefore needs nothing from us. God is just desiring our faith. The thing God desires is that we trust him. That's why faith, as I've said before, is the only currency God accepts. Nothing else is going to turn him toward us. Faith is responding to him turning toward us. It's God's actions that initiate the faith he desires. You see, what Israel needed from Jephthah, in fact, from any judge, any deliverer the Lord sent them, was one who would be faithful to the end. Israel needed a deliverer who didn't pursue selfish ambition, who didn't seek only what he could get. Israel needed a deliverer who would gladly take on the suffering of others, including the very curse of the law. Israel needed a savior who would embrace the suffering caused by the sins of others, rather than force others to try to make up for his own sins. This means Jephthah was but a shadow of such a deliverer. He was the darkest shadow of the king who was coming. He was supposed to point his people to the one who would truly deliver his people, but rather than reflect the coming king's character, he was a grim reminder of all that the coming king is not. See, God has declared he would save his people. All those who respond to this promise in faith, even the tiniest bit of faith that is barely detectable to you and to me, all of them receive the promise of salvation. This isn't because the one trusting is so very great, but because the one who promised is so very great. I love how the author of Hebrews puts it. He said in chapter 6, "For when God made a promise to Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, 'Surely I will bless you and multiply you.' And thus Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise. For people swear by something greater than themselves, and in all their disputes, an oath is final for confirmation. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath." There is no negotiating with God. He determined to save and swore an oath to save all those who trust in him. That, my friends, is a true vow. That is a vow that cannot be broken, one that in fact cost the Lord everything in order to fulfill. That's the price our deliverer was willing to pay to rescue his people. That's one we can trust in.